Hi, it's Tori DeVito. In every family, small conversations can make a big impact. Like when my dad shared his experiences as an alcoholic.
Your honesty about that part of your life gave me a sense of integrity that I wanted to uphold in my own life.
I wanted you to know from someone who's been in recovery more than 30 years now that hard work is what creates success, not alcohol or other drugs. I said it a lot, and I'm glad you took it to heart.
Talk. They hear you. For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
WRCT in sound from Way Out.
WRCT Pittsburgh, your oil revival station.
I'm really trying. I'm Satan. boy was in the hallway drinking a glass of tea. From the other end of the hallway, a rhythm was generating. Another boy was sliding up the hallway. His golden nerves merged perfectly. He merged perfectly with the hallway. He merged perfectly the mirror in the hallway. The boy looked at Johnny. Johnny wanted to run, but the movie kept moving as planned. The boy took Johnny, he pressed him against a locker. He drove it in, he drove it home, he drove it deep in Johnny. The boy disappeared. Johnny fell on his knees, started crashing his head against a locker. Started crashing his head against a locker. Started laughing hysterically when suddenly Johnny gets a feeling. He's been surrounded by horses, 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 coming in all directions, white, shining, silver, studs with their nose in flames. He saw horses, 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 singing a hound of pony, like Boney Maroney. Do you know the twist?
Like I said, I felt his hand on my knee, on the screen, and were coming in like Arabian stallions, gradually lapping into seahorses. He picked up the blade and he pressed it against his smooth throat, spoon, and let it dip in the veins, dip in to the sea of possibilities. Dip in,
started hardening in my hand,
to the sea,
and I felt the arrows of possibilities.
I put my hand inside his cranium. Oh, we had such a brainiac, no more, but no more, no more. I gotta move from my mind to the air. Go, go, gotta go and do the Y2C. Yeah, do the Y2C. Do the Y2C. Shine open, coiled snakes, white and shining, twirling and circling. Our lives are now entwined. We will fall, yes, together, twining your nerves, your mane of the black shining horse in my fingers. All entwined, your silky hair. I can feel it. It was still the hair going through my fingers. The hairs were like fire. Red stream went streaming through the sands like fingers, like arteries.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Al-Ateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. Call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, on a Sunday night, not when officials do things they're most proud of, House Republicans passed a plan to give more money to rich people by taking it from the non-rich. Call it what you will, that's what's ultimately happening with the plan to cut more than $700 billion from Medicaid in order to offset, as elite media have it, the expense of relieving millionaires from contributing to public coffers. Even the feint they're using, we're not cutting aid, we're just forcing recipients to work like they should, is obvious, age-old, and long disproven, if evidence is what you care about. The thing is, the millions of people at the sharp end of this plan, most of them are children who have no voice corporate media feel obliged to listen to. We will nevertheless talk about them with independent journalist Bryce Covert. Also on the show, you may have seen an editorial in the Washington Post indicating that despite what you've heard for years from trans people themselves and from doctors and medical associations that work with trans people, maybe it's okay for you to entertain the notion that, weirdly, on this occasion, it's not science, but talk show hosts who have it right. And trans kids are just actually mentally ill. We'll talk about that with journalist and trans rights activist Aaron Reed of Aaron in the Morning. That's coming up. We'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Welcome to USA 2025, where the only immigrants deserving welcome are white South Africans. Germ theory is just some folks' opinion, and attaching work requirements to Medicaid and SNAP benefits will make recipients stop being lazy and get a job. Everything old is not new again, but many things that are old, perverse, and discredited are getting dusted off and reintroduced with a vengeance. Our guest has reported the repeatedly offered rationales behind tying work requirements to social benefits and the real-world impacts of those efforts for many years now. Bryce Covert is an independent journalist and a contributing writer at The Nation. She joins us now by phone from Brooklyn. Welcome back to Counterspin, Bryce Covert.
Thank you so much for having me back on.
Well, most right-wing, top-down campaigns rely on some element of myth. But this is pretty much all myth, that there's a problem. Medicaid and also SNAP benefits discourage recipients from seeking work, that this response will increase employment, that it will save the state and federal government money, and that it won't harm those most in need. It's layer upon layer of falsehood that you have spent years breaking down. Where do you even start?
That's a great place to start. pointing out those claims essentially are all false. And I think it's important to know the reason we know that those things are false is because we have years of experience in this country with work requirements and various programs, and they have produced the same results over and over again. So this started essentially with welfare, which is now known as temporary assistance for needy families. In the 1990s, cash assistance to families. There was a work requirement imposed on recipients in that program that still stands today. And just wave after wave of research has found these requirements did not help increase employment on a long-term basis. Most people were not actually working after they were subjected to the work requirement. And instead, it increased poverty, it reduced the recipients of these benefits. So it essentially didn't help them get to work, but it did take away the money that they were relying on. That pattern plays out over and over again. And we have some newer evidence in Medicaid, because up until the first Trump administration, states could not impose a work requirement in Medicaid. The Trump administration allowed waivers to do so. Only one state actually did it, but Arkansas, the state that did, imposed this work requirement and kicked over 18,000 people off the program with no discernible impact on employment.
Well, and it has to do with a misunderstanding about who Medicaid recipients are and their relationship to the workplace, period, right?
Right. Most Medicaid recipients are either working or have some good reasons for why they're not working. Either they can't find full-time work, or they have conflicts, like they're taking care of family members. People are disabled. Many of them have an official disability and they're on the actual disability program, but many more are disabled and can't get on that program. It is a very difficult program to enroll in. The burdens to enrollment are super, super high. And others say it's because they are in school or they're trying to find work or they're retired. So among those who aren't working, there's not a lot who are in any good position to go out and start working. And that's true of a lot of recipients of other public benefits as well. So when you talk about imposing a work requirement on people in Medicaid, what you're doing is adding administrative burden, which is to say extra steps they have to take to keep getting their benefits that aren't going to actually change the situation they're facing when it comes to their employment.
Well, when you wrote about Mississippi, I know with TAMF, you were saying, you know, you had to prove you had a job or were searching for one before you could get help with childcare. And if people would just take a second and think, how do you search for a job or hold a job without childcare? You know, so it's not even logical. It's more a kind of moral, strange misunderstanding of why people are outside of the workforce.
I think this applies to other programs too. It's hard to get to work if you don't have health insurance like Medicaid to get yourself healthy and in a good working position. You know, if you're not able to get food stamps and buy food for yourself, it's going to be hard to be out there looking for a job. These are basic necessities. And I think that's another really important point to make here is that Republicans have tried to paint lots of different programs as quote-unquote welfare because that word is very stigmatizing. But what we're talking about with Medicaid is health care. We are talking about feeling as if we need to force people to work, although really what we're doing is forcing them to document on some pieces of paper that they're working, which is an important distinction, in order to get health care, in order to take care of their bodies and be healthy. Same with food stamps. We're saying you must work in order to eat. These are basic, basic necessities that people need simply to survive.
Well, and then we hear about the dignity of work. You need to work because there's dignity there. And yet somehow a person whose grandfather owned the steel mill doesn't need that dignity. You know, wealthy people who don't work somehow are outside of this moral conversation.
Yeah, and, you know, we're talking about this imposing work requirements on SNAP and Medicaid, which is what Republicans say they want to do, in the service of tax cuts for the wealthy. I mean, essentially, they are literally paying for tax cuts for the wealthy to return more money to the rich by cutting programs for the poor, and those rich people, many of them do not work, or these tax breaks help them to avoid work, you know, the inheritance tax, for example. So that moral obligation to work does not apply.
Well, the New York Times column recently from four Trump officials that I don't remember the headline, but it was something like, if you can work, you must, you know. They didn't marshal any evidence. They didn't have data, just vibes. Those are some racist, racist vibes, aren't they?
Yes, that is an important point, that all of this cannot be separated out from racism. I mean, the conversation over welfare and TANF in the 1990s, that was all race. It was about white Americans feeling like black Americans were getting the dole and were too lazy to work and had to be forced to work. The numbers at the time did not bear that out. More white Americans were getting cash assistance than black ones. But it's a really deep-seated belief among Americans. And I think when you see, as in that op-ed, for example, or other places where Republicans are trying to call these other programs, quote-unquote, welfare, it's barely even just a dog whistle. It is pretty blatant that they are trying to paint other programs as things that help black people who are too lazy to work. It's all caught up in that idea, even though, again, the numbers do not bear this out. White people are more likely to be on these programs. We see equal employment rates among both populations. This is not actually a problem to solve for, but it is one I think a lot of Americans, unfortunately, really believe.
Well, I'm going to ask you about media in another second. I just wanted to pull up another point about the racism, which is that it's not just the mythologizing and the welfare queen that those of us who are old enough will remember, but you wrote about how states with larger black populations have stricter rules, and how when states were asked for exemptions on pushing these work requirements, they exempted majority white counties. So it's not just the racism in the rationale, the racism in how it plays out is there too.
Absolutely. I mean, these policies hit black people more heavily. They are more stringently applied in southern states that have higher black populations, that are more hostile to their black populations. And like you said, in the first Trump administration, when states were seeking exemptions, it was more majority white populations who got them. I mean, this is just really a fundamental racist myth we have in this country that's proven very hard to shake, that black people are lazy and rely on the government to get by and must be forced to work, when just nothing about the actual numbers and data bears that out.
I sometimes feel like reporters, even if they're well-intentioned and trying to make it personal, they can kind of make it a thought experiment for folks who are better off. Like, if you were struggling, wouldn't you take the time to fill out a form? You know, it's just paperwork. Couldn't you go across town to the office and fill out that form? And it just represents a total disconnect, experiential disconnect, between anyone who has ever had to deal with this and those who have no idea about it at all, and just kind of parachute in and say, oh, wow, filling out a form, what's the big deal?
Yeah, I think most well-off Americans have no idea how hard it is to apply for these programs, to stay on these programs, the paperwork that's involved, the time that's involved. And also, when we've seen work requirements in Medicaid, for example, they are set up in a very complex way. Arkansas's website was only available during the working day, and then it would shut down, and you couldn't log your work requirement hours at night. And I think that belies the fact that this is not about, in fact, helping people to work. This is instead about kicking people off the program. And you can see that in the fact that the reason Republicans are talking about work requirements right now is because they need to find spending savings to pay for the tax cuts. If this were not about kicking people off and spending less on benefits, then this wouldn't be part of this current conversation about their one big, beautiful bill. So these are huge administrative burdens. And it's also a big burden for something that is a deep necessity. I think the mental impact, the emotional impact of being made to jump through these huge hoops for something as basic as food, it's really extreme. You know, I, for example, I recently had to go to the DMV to get my real ID. And, you know, I had to go to the office in person. I had to wait for hours. I had to bring all the right paperwork. It was a huge burden. But this was for something that would just make it a little easier to travel on an airplane. Think about going through the same process, you know, having to show up somewhere in person, waiting for hours, making sure you have all the right documentation. And if you don't, then you don't get the thing that you're seeking. But what we're talking about is whether or not you get health care. What we're talking about is whether you get food stamps. I think it's an experience that's hard for people who haven't gone through it to grasp.
Well, to bring it back to today, May 21st, some coverage that I'm reading straight up says some 8.6 million people are going to find themselves uninsured. Other stories matter-of-factly describe work requirements and some Republicans' anger that they're not going to kick in sooner as about offsetting the tax cuts for the wealthy, as though we're just kind of recalibrating and this is going to balance things in a natural way. I guess I would say I'm not getting the energy that there are 14 million children who rely on both Medicaid and SNAP, and there's children who could lose health care and food at the same time, and that includes 20% of all children under the age of five. From news media, I'm getting Republicans versus Democrats. I'm not so much getting children versus hunger.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, these kinds of political debates tend to sort of be covered like they are just a political back and forth. Mm-hmm. You know, Democrats think this, Republicans think that. Mm-hmm. It is legitimately harder to explain to people what this will mean in real life. You know, I have reported on the impact of work requirements. For example, I went to Arkansas when they were in effect. It's hard to report on. The people who are impacted are vulnerable. They have chaotic lives. They may not even know that they are subject to it. Unfortunately, I think it's likely that if this passes and these cuts are implemented, we will see more stories about what happens because it will be a little easier to say concretely, this kid right here doesn't get food or health care anymore. But it would be nice to have that conveyed ahead of time so the public understood what was happening before it went into effect.
We've been speaking with independent reporter Bryce Covert. You can find her work online at brycecovert.com. Bryce Covert, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Washington Post and Amazon owner Jeff Bezos was clear in saying that only certain ideological presuppositions would be acceptable from here on in. When the paper canceled a prepared endorsement of Kamala Harris for president and canceled a cartoon critical of Donald Trump and a number of other things. And that sound you heard was many people moving the Washington Post from one place to another in their brains. But the Post is still the leading daily in the lawmaking place of this country, and what they say has influence on people who have influence. So when the Post editorial board described a report on trans health care from the Health and Human Services Department, now headed by Robert F., I don't think people should be taking medical advice from me, Kennedy Jr., as thorough and careful, that was going to have an impact. The piece, headed Good Questions About Transgender Care, really raised deeper questions about corporate news media and their role in the world we have and the world we need today. Erin Reed is the journalist and activist behind Erin in the Morning. She joins us now by phone from Gaithersburg, Maryland. Welcome to Counterspin, Erin Reed.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, an idea can be utterly discredited evidentially, scientifically, but can still have resonance for people who just feel like certain things are true. The Post says that, well, first they point out that this HHS report is more than 400 pages, including appendixes. So, you know, you're supposed to sit up straight. But the message is that the HHS report is a review of the existing literature on best practices around trans health care and that it's careful and thorough. I feel like when anti-trans media is cartoonish, it's almost easier to bat away, but when something like this comes from a paper of record, it makes it more difficult. So let me just ask you, what are you making of this Post editorial?
Yeah, so, you know, a little bit of background. This HHS report was produced specifically because the science on transgender healthcare has been so clear for so long. There's been repeated study after study coming out in the most prestigious journal showing the positive impact of transgender healthcare on those who need it. And so the HHS report was put out in order to give cover to organizations that want to oppose transgender healthcare. And that's what we got with the Washington Post editorial page, where the editorial board basically endorses the report. It goes through the report and says that it's a great report, essentially, and that it raises great questions about transgender health care and more. Whenever I read something like that from the Washington Post editorial board, though, and then I see how that same board and how that same paper treats everything else that RFK Jr.'s healthcare team puts out, for instance, right. vaccines, autism, fluoridation in water, and more. There's this sort of double standard whenever it comes to transgender healthcare. The paper is willing to point out the lack of science behind this particular department's positions under RFK Jr. for all of these other things, but it seemingly ignores that whenever it comes to transgender people.
And they refer to they're scientistic, you know. They say that, oh, well, this report concurs with other systematic reviews. They give all the gesturing towards the idea that this is science here, and yet it's not.
And, you know, the report itself was anonymously written. We, you know, they didn't release any of the names of the people who worked on the report. However, they left the excerpt data in, and so you could actually see the person who compiled the report, and it was Alex Byrne, is the one who's on the excerpt data in the PDF. And what that says is that they're not using experts here. Alex Byrne is a philosophy major. Like, that's not somebody who's ever worked with gender-affirming healthcare, not somebody who's ever worked with transgender people. We are seeing these attacks on transgender healthcare using these mechanisms like the RFK Jr. Healthcare Department trying to dictate what science is by fiat, trying to say that it doesn't matter what the studies say. It doesn't matter that all the medical organizations and the people that work with transgender people say that this healthcare is saving lives. We are going to dictate what is science and what is not. You know, I read the whole 400-page report. I read all of anything that comes out about transgender healthcare because that's my job. I'm a journalist covering this topic. And the report, if you read it, it's not a scientific document. It's not something that has new information. It's not something that studies transgender healthcare. It dead names historical transgender figures. It calls transgender healthcare social contagion. And it advocates for conversion therapy of transgender people, explicitly so, in many instances. And so I don't think that what we have is a good scientific document that raises important questions on transgender healthcare, like the Washington Post editorial board claims. Instead, what we have is another example of the relentless pseudoscience coming out of this healthcare department under RFK Jr.
Well, part of that involves relabeling, and you just mentioned conversion therapy, and I think a lot of listeners will say, oh, I've learned about what that means. It involves telling queer people they're not queer, they're mentally ill, and, you know, but the Post has something to say about how, or maybe it's the report itself, how, oh, no, this isn't conversion therapy. What's going on there?
Yeah, so the original report advocates for something known as gender exploratory therapy. And I have done a lot of investigations on this particular modality of therapy that's being promoted by people on the anti-trans right. So gender exploratory therapy, it sounds good. It sounds like something that we want. But of course, if somebody is transitioning, we would love for them to have a good and open environment to explore their gender identity. And that is what we have right now. But that's not what gender exploratory therapy is. Gender exploratory therapy is a very kind-sounding name for a repackaged version of conversion therapy. Essentially, what this modality of therapy does is, let's say you're a transgender youth, you're, you know, 14, 15, 16 years old, and you are considering transitioning. What they will do is they will take you and they will try to blame your gender identity on anything other than being trans repeatedly. They'll go from thing to thing to thing to thing. And the important point here is that these therapists will never approve your transition. They will never write a gender-affirming care letter for you. They explicitly won't do that. If you go to the website that founded this group, the Gender Exploratory Therapy Association website, you'll find that this group has filed amicus briefs against transgender bathroom usage in schools, or that this group has filed amicus briefs against, you know, transgender participation in sports like darts. We see that this is not a neutral sort of modality. The closest comparison that many of your listeners will probably understand is crisis pregnancy centers, mm-hmm. where they've used this name, crisis pregnancy centers, to try to say that if you're seeking an abortion, that this is a good clinic to go to. But if you know anything about crisis pregnancy centers, the way that they work is by delaying abortion until it's no longer feasible. And that's the exact same way that GETA works. And that's what we see being promoted by this report.
Well, finally, in terms of media, who we know often or virtually always set things up in a some say others differ framework, you know, they're quoting the Washington Post editorial and other outlets are acknowledging the place where they say critics have been scathing. This is the Post. Critics have been scathing about what they see as the report's biases and shortcomings, but it makes a legitimate case for caution that policymakers need to wrestle with. And I would just ask you finally to talk about this media idea of somehow the truth is in the middle on issues. And then also, oh, all we're asking for is caution. You know, who's against caution? And, oh, sorry. And additionally, anyone who criticizes it is an activist and an interested party other than these sort of disinterested scientists and ethicists at the Washington Post.
So I'm actually going to push back slightly and make an even broader point here.
Please.
Both sides coverage and sort of the truth is in the middle coverage and giving both sides a chance to make their point, that would be an improvement
yes.
to what we have
yes.
right now with transgender reporting and reporting on transgender healthcare.
Absolutely.
Because let me tell you, whenever you look at the New York Times, whenever you look at the Washington Post and the way that transgender healthcare is covered right now, the experts, the transgender people, the transgender journalists, like myself, are not given the space to make their points. They're not given the space to make the case for scientific healthcare and for good treatment of LGBTQ people and transgender people. But you'll see the New York Times publish, you know, 3-4-page spreads attacking transgender healthcare from people who have made it their job to attack transgender people. You'll see the editorial board at the Washington Post explicitly advocate for, you know, a healthcare report done by the RFK Jr. healthcare team targeting transgender people. And whenever it comes to the transgender people and whenever it comes to the experts and the medical organizations and the Yale physicians, they're written off as just activists. And so this is not even both sides reporting. It's not even the truth is in the middle reporting. These papers have taken a position on this. And it's a position that's not supported by the science. It's a position that's not being practiced, importantly, by the people who are giving out that transgender health care, who are treating transgender people day in, day out, who see these patients and understand the impact that gender-affirming care has on their lives. So I guess what I'm just really trying to say is, I wish they would platform transgender people. I wish they would platform the doctors. I wish they would platform the medical organizations, but they don't.
It feels like you're telling me what better reporting would look like, yeah?
I'm trying.
Aaron Reed is the journalist and activist behind Aaron in the Morning. Thank you so much, Aaron Reed, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find that info on our website, fair.org. Also, the place to show much-needed support for the show if you're able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Michael Cherry. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you can say someone supports the rights of people of color to vote or to have our experience and history recognized, as though that were a passive descriptor. She supports the rights of people of color to be seen and heard. The homepage of the Kairos Democracy Project has a quote from John Lewis, reminding us that democracy is not a state, it is an act. Tanya Clay House is board chair at Kairos and a longtime advocate for the multiracial democracy that the Trump White House seeks to denounce and derail, in part by erasing the history of Black people in this country. As part of that, she's part of an ongoing project called Freedom to Learn, and their present campaign called Hands Off Our History. We'll hear from Tanya Clay House about that work today.